Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Since Facebook opened its platform to independent applications in 2007, social games where cartoon avatars buy, sell, and swap virtual goods have exploded as the clear killer app. 30% of all Facebook visits are to play games. An estimated 80 million users logged on to play the game Farmville alone last May. Now, established media companies and Silicon Valley startups alike are scrambling to get in on the big profits behind the gameplay. This hour on Point, what the social gaming craze means. First, joining me from Seattle, Washington this hour is Nick Wingfield. He is technology reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He's been covering the business of social games. Nick Wingfield, welcome to the program. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
So Fortune magazine says social gaming is as, quote, ubiquitous and mainstream as primetime TV programming. Can you describe for us the rise in popularity of social gaming in really a very short period of time?
Yeah, well, it's really been a phenomenon that's piggybacked on the social networking phenomenon, mainly Facebook. And as you described, it's sort of a killer app for social networks. What happens is there are these very simple games, kind of graphically, you know, crude almost, cartoony games, but they spread virally because people start competing with their, you know, other members of their social network. They start wanting to get higher scores than friends. And so it really kind of snowballs, and Farmville is one of the big games there, and it's just really exploded on the basis of these social networks, which are very effective ways of communicating your achievements within these games to other people you know.
So what's the draw of these games? What's the point?
You know, it's really interesting. I mean, they're casual games, so they're very easy and accessible to play. They're not like Halo or, you know, any of the big fancy games that you usually play on a game console on your TV set. And they're time wasters for some people. For others, there's a kind of the motivation is just sort of status within other people, you know, the community of other people who play these games. And, you know, as far as the business side goes, people get so deeply engaged with these things that they actually start buying virtual goods within the game so that they can, you know, beat their friends and have, you know, better uniforms or better vehicles or better farms.
I'm reading the most popular social gaming site called the Zynga Game Network reached 100 million users in just the last 2.5 years. It's an incredible phenomenon. What's the demographic of the average player of these games?
Well, it varies. I mean, each of these different games have slightly different audiences. One of the companies, Playdom, has a game about, like, sororities, and so that's a very female-oriented game. Usually, I think it may be slightly more female, but it varies by games, and it kind of maps pretty closely to the Facebook demographic, which tends to be a bit younger, but it's really all over the map depending on the type of game we're talking about.
There's big money associated with social gaming. You mentioned Playdom. Disney, I'm reading here in the New York Times, just bought Playdom for $763 million. Tell me, what's in it for these big companies? Google, Disney, GameStop, they're all investing. What do they want? What's the stake in these social gaming?
Well, it's a high-growth area. These game companies, social games companies, are building audiences fast, and they are relatively inexpensive compared to some of the other big traditional games companies that are out there. So Playdom was one of the few social games companies that had a fair amount of traction that could still be acquired. You mentioned Zynga before. They're the leader in the social games category. They're rumored to have a multi-billion-dollar value. It's still a private company, but with a value like that, it really makes them unacquirable for all but a few of the largest technology companies out there. But really what they're after is growth, and it's an exciting new area with a younger demographic. And Disney in particular sees it as an opportunity to start pumping some of their traditional characters and brands like ESPN and the Pixar characters into this new social gaming world.
So gaming is really the future of social media.
It really is definitely one of the futures of social media, and it's also a pretty profitable area. This virtual goods business out there, of course, there's no manufacturing cost to making a virtual currency or anything like that. So these companies tend to be pretty profitable. Mm.
Nick Wingfield, thank you very much. A technology reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He joined me from Seattle, Washington. Nick, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Joining me now in the studio is Mia Consalvo. She's a visiting associate professor in comparative media studies at Singapore MIT's Gambit Game Lab, where she studies digital and casual games, new media, and women's gameplay. Mia Consalvo, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also joining me from New York is Frank Lanz. He's co-founder and creative director of Area Code, which is a New York-based game design company. He's developed two social games for Facebook and is working on a third. Frank Lanz, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be here.
Mia Consalvo, I'll start with you. You study this stuff. Define for us social gaming.
Well, a lot of it is like what Nick mentioned, but these are games that are pretty much all free to play, and most people continue to play them for free. You know, a few get really into it and start buying virtual currency with them. But they're games that are easy to pick up and figure out. And I think what they do partly is offer, you know, a sense of immediate gratification, a sense of accomplishment, and then they start luring you in, and they encourage you usually to check in frequently. They're usually games that you can't play for a long period of time. They're played in short bursts.
And 15 minutes or so.
5 minutes even. 5 minutes, 15 minutes. 15 minutes would be a long time. But then they encourage you to come back with the mechanics that they've designed in. So you might be coming back at first, you know, like once a day, and then you find yourself coming back twice a day. And some people maybe have the window, you know, tabbed in their browser, and they're checking back every 10, 15 minutes.
Is this like gambling? I mean, is this online video game playing? I mean, what is this? Paint the picture for us. What is actually going on the screen?
Well, I don't know if it's gambling. You know, there is, like I mentioned, a sense of gratification. Like with Farmville, as we were saying, you know, you start off and you have a very simple plot of land. And, you know, you plant some strawberries and you come back in 4 hours and they've bloomed. And you think, wow, these are great. You know, I get my strawberries and I can cash it in for coin and I can plant more strawberries. But now I can also buy green beans and plant those. And they look different when they come ripe and you harvest them. And it slowly draws you in. And these games also to advance, you know, they encourage you to invite your friends to be your neighbors. And part of, you know, what makes these companies successful is something like Farmville. You know that so many people are playing, it's likely that a lot of your friends are playing too. And you you invite them to be your neighbors, you visit their farms, you can fertilize their crops, they come by and fertilize yours. It helps you yield better strawberries, you know, for more coin.
So that's the social networking piece.
Right.
And you can also buy a tractor or whatever, a stack of green beans for X amount of dollars, $2, $5.
Right.
It's micro amounts.
Right, exactly. So, you know, you can, some of it is just simply status. You know, they sell these items usually in limited edition. Not sure why, you know, you can create as many digital pink tractors as you'd like. But, you know, if you have one, your friends visit your farm, they see it, they think, oh, that's really cool. You know, she's this really advanced player. You can also use them to kind of fast forward time. So you've got to, you know, plant new crops, you've got to fertilize those fields, you buy the tractors, save time doing that, but then it needs gas. It can refill automatically if you wait, but if you don't want to wait, you can pay money. So suddenly you're paying money to fertilize your virtual crops.
This is an ongoing kind of thing.
Yes.
This can go on and on
right.
and on. Frank Lanz, your company has developed two social games for Facebook. You're about to release another. What's the appeal to your mind?
Well, one of the core appeals of the kind of game that that we're describing here is that it's a resource management game. It's a scheduling game. It gives you the satisfaction of having a clearly defined set of tasks that you can check off, these little interlocking tasks. And sort of unlike your regular life, which is messy and you kind of never feel like you're on top of it, this is a clearly defined little universe in which you have these little challenges. They're simple, maybe even trivial to accomplish, but you can accomplish them, and there's something satisfying about that.
So resource management, is there strategy? Is there skill? Or is it just watching virtual plants grow?
Yeah, I mean, there can be skill, and I mean, I think there is a lot of anxiety about these kinds of games in among mainstream gamers and game developers, and there's a lot of criticism that they are skill-less, that there's really nothing going on here except little kind of reward payoffs and a little intermittent schedule, and that's the part of it that feels like playing a slot machine. It feels like gambling. There is no skill in really playing a slot machine. You're just pulling the lever, and that there's a bit of that going on in these games, but I think that's an exaggeration. I think for a lot of these people who are playing these games and are into these games, they're enjoying the process of kind of optimizing their schedule, of thinking about how and when to do these tasks in a way that maximizes their effectiveness. And that's problem solving, and that's a different version of the same kind of pleasure that you get from playing a more intense or more challenging game.
And Mia, you study this. Who's playing these? What's the demographic? Is it more people than you think? They're just not admitting it?
Exactly. You know, if you ask people if they're gamers, 9 times out of 10, they'll say no. But if you wait in silence or you say, what about Facebook or, you know, what about your phone? And they start admitting that they play these types of games. And so it can be your mom, your grandmom, your uncle, you know, your dean at your university. And as Nick was saying earlier, it can vary across game, but I've met people of all ages, both genders, ethnicities, that play these types of games.
I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about social games this hour. What about that statistic, Mia, that social games are most popular with 30-something women?
Sure. I would say it's also drawing from the popularity of casual games among women, especially older women. You know, again, these are games that are easy to play. You know, you can learn how to play them pretty quickly. You can play them either for brief bursts of time or for long periods of time. And I've found women who admit to playing several times a day for 2 or more hours at a time each stretch. And they really enjoy them. They're really knowledgeable about the different games, the different genres of casual and social games. And they're just this new demographic that's come up.
What about the business model of social gaming, Frank Lanz? I mean, you're in this from the business side of it. Why is it a more profitable model than traditional video games, say?
Well, partly because traditional mainstream video games are extremely expensive to produce, and they are operating on a kind of straightforward sort of commerce model of just product, that you purchase a disc, and that's where the money comes from. Whereas social games are more like services. And I think this is just part of a larger trend that is moving towards digital, distributed kind of service models. I think we're going to see that move happen across all kinds of games.
There are critics who say, Frank, that these games are just a clever and quite efficient way to get internet users to provide their credit card information.
What?
yes. Yeah.
I think that there's some truth to that. Yeah, I mean, part of the bad feeling that a lot of people have about these games is that they have tended to be very crass about the way that they try to reproduce themselves through different viral techniques of automatic posting to your Facebook stream and constantly interrupting the action to try to get you to purchase things that you don't really want or need. That has left a bad taste in people's mouths.
Let's hear from some of our listeners who may, in fact, have played these games. Hi, India. I'm calling from Boston. You're on the line. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am 37, so I fall into that category that Mia was talking about. I recently sold my business and decided to take some time off, and in doing so was over overwhelmed by how much time I had on my hands. Didn't have really a big cash flow, and although I used to make fun of my older sister for participating in things like Yeovil, I found myself lured in, and it did give me a really great sense of accomplishment. I was sort of sofa surfing for like a year and a half, and it gave me like a sense that I kind of had my own house, and I could decorate it and move things around and buy stuff for it. And it was when I got to that point that made Frank gasp, which is that I actually purchased something with real money that I said, uh-oh, this isn't good.
And how much did you spend?
Not that much. I mean, maybe like $30 total. So it wasn't bad, but I can see how, you know, you can tell on Yeovil that there are certain things that you can't earn. You have to buy with real money. And you see these other characters out there and they have these things and you realize that these people must spend, you know, an exorbitant amount of money and time. And basically the moment literally that I got a new job, a couple months later, you know, bought a new house, it just absolutely utterly lost interest. And I have this virtual house sitting out there that's full of really fun, cool stuff. And I haven't been on there in months and months now.
Well, India, thank you. Good luck with your new job. Although I have to say I'm reading companies who do research to alter games to fit people's work schedules. Frank Lanz.
Sure. I think that the way that these games are designed is they're constantly iterated on an ongoing basis to respond to player behavior. And so that doesn't surprise me at all.
And like the caller was saying, these are games that can fit into your life, you know, and if you have more time available, they'll balloon out to as much time as you want to give to them. And then they may shrink and go away. You know, I mean, a lot of these games, you know, are different than if you think about like an Xbox 360 game where you have to, sitting down, you think, I'm going to devote 4 hours to this tonight, and you have to in order to make any progress within the game. You know, these are games that you can play on your PC and your laptop. You can play for 5 or 10 minutes and make that progress. And so there's less investment, and it's enjoyable, just like, you know, other activities, watching TV for a little bit, you know, watching a little bit of a movie.
There was something a little bit sad about that call, though, the way she talked about how the game kind of served as a replacement for the things that, you know, she wasn't accomplishing in her life. And I think that there's some truth to that. And it's a little, you know, it's a little bit scary when you think of a person using a game purely as escapist fantasy or a kind of easy way to plug in and get some satisfaction or pleasure that's a replacement for something that's missing from their life. And so, I think that rings a warning
bell. It's a good point, Mia. What does it say about us that so many of us have to go to cyberspace to raise, you know, virtual asparagus and
well,
and have fun?
I would kill real asparagus if I had to raise it. But and my asparagus always blooms in Farmville. I think that, I don't know, I disagree a little bit with what Frank is saying. I think we can look at the context of use. And, you know, if this becomes a total substitute, you know, for a daily interaction, for achievements in your life, you know, then that's certainly problematic. And we've seen that behavior happen, you know, with things like World of Warcraft players. But if you're using it kind of in the interim, you know, as a little bit of a substitute when you may not have that, you know, I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing.
Here's Stephen.
No, you're right.
He's calling from London. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
I would just like to mention, I don't play any of these games at all, and Facebook makes it very difficult to ignore them. I've repeatedly had to hide each individual game. I don't know at what pace they're being developed, but it seems like I spend far too much time pressing the hide button.
Yeah, it's annoying.
Stephen, thank you. There are people, Frank, who are very annoyed by all the updates that Facebook sends out about these games.
Yeah, and Facebook itself is making an effort to curb that. So they're making it a little bit stricter, and you won't see. I mean, the golden age of Facebook game spam is over, and I think it's going to taper off a good bit. But it's still out there, and it's I find it annoying as well.
I think that also, you know, some users have begun to sort of self-edit themselves. People who would initially, you know, post every single achievement that they got in every game, you know, have started getting annoyed messages from their friends filling up their walls and their inboxes, and so they're starting to pull back a little too.
Talk about the lucrative business nature of this endeavor of social gaming, Frank Lanz. I mean, you're creative director of a company. You've just developed two social games for Facebook. Mm-hmm. You're about to release another. I mean, this is the big future of social media here. I mean, how much are you investing and how much do you hope to get out of this?
Well, I mean, for me personally, the thing that's most exciting about it is actually the creative possibilities. So, I mean, my focus at AeriCode is on game design and creating games that are high quality and fun and interesting and innovative. And I'm also interested in making money. I love money. It's awesome. And, you know, I want to make a lot of money from Facebook games. But I think that we have a slightly different focus, which is that this is a platform that allows for new kinds of games, that it's not just that it's a money spigot, but that it is a new audience, a broad audience, and a kind of gaming with this kind of asynchronous, intermittent, persistent play that's embedded within a social context. I mean, that's an opportunity to do some cool new kinds of game design. And I think we're going to see more innovation and more new kinds of games emerge. You know, in terms of the lucrative nature of it, yes, it's definitely big business and people are excited about it. But I think ultimately what we've seen in the past year or so is a lot of money that's been made almost by accident. It's almost that the scale of how many people are playing is so large that you're getting like lots and lots of money just in the margins of this system. A small set of people spending a lot of money, or a large number of people spending little bits of money here and there. And I think moving forward, we're going to see more of a focus on quality, on the quality of the experience, and a more savvy audience that's looking for kind of higher quality.
And that's the interesting business model, Mia. Lots of people spending very small amounts of money.
Right. And I mean, it's not something that's entirely new to games. I mean, people spend money, lots of money, on things like ringtones for their phones and, you know, other things that are virtual that you can't touch. And because it's small, you know, if you think 50 cents, a dollar, or maybe, you know, you're spending $20, you know, you say to yourself one time only, you know, you can easily justify that.
Here's Amy from Lowell, Massachusetts. Hi, Amy. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Hi. Thanks.
Uh-huh.
Well, I had a situation in my last position where I worked where there was a young sales rep who was addicted. I think it was called Fishville. Does that sound right?
Maybe. Yes.
It was a fish game on Facebook where you had to, it was similar to Farmville, you have to feed your fish, you know, every 5 minutes or something. And she ended up getting fired, and one of the reasons was that, you know, she was addicted to this game. It wasn't the only reason. You know, self-discipline obviously is an issue, and people who can't control themselves when it comes to these types of games, and it ends up really hurting their productivity at work. I mean, I think that certainly should be a concern.
And
yeah,
so,
that's that.
Yeah, Amy, thank you. Frank?
That's a legitimate problem. And, you know, these things are complicated. Like, games are a form of pop culture. And, you know, the question is, what do we want out of our pop culture? Do we want things that provide more than just kind of pure compulsion? I think, you know, that's a legitimate question.
Mia, you play these games. What's in it for you?
Fun. A chance to kind of see what my friends are up to in these games as well. I think one thing we haven't mentioned here is some of these games do offer the opportunity for creativity. So even with something like Farmville, which, you know, people question, you know, if you need any skill, I know people and I have friends who really kind of rejected the farming to get ahead model, but used their space to design interesting graphics, you know, with different colored hay bales and different elements that they could place out, not just like an aesthetically pleasing farm, but messages and, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff. And this is something that people are using the games for as well that I don't think we've really talked about.
Dipping into the artistic pocket of your personality, Frank.
Definitely.
Sure. No, I think it's important to note that, you know, we're talking about a handful of games, Farmville, and this one kind of paradigm of resource management, very simple progress over time. But there's all kinds of other games that are happening on Facebook. I mean, people play poker on Facebook. People play Bejeweled on Facebook. And there are different kinds of games and game styles that will emerge. I don't think that we're going to see this one type of farming style gameplay define this platform for very much longer.
Here's Mark in New Britain, Connecticut. Hi, Mark. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Certainly.
And I guess timing is everything, because I was just thinking that the resource management games have always left me cold, and I've never actually been on Facebook. I have no interest in Facebook, but I've gotten drawn into a game, a web game that uses Twitter for its social aspects. That I'm wondering if it's on your radar at all. The name of the game is Echo Bazaar, although the players tend to call it Fallen London. It's a storytelling game. It's set in this wonderfully creepy gothic sort of London by gaslight setting, and it's got a fabulously elaborate branched storytelling model where you know, different players can come in and start from the same three or four choices and go off on virtually infinite number of character development pathways.
And so, Mark, how often do you play this game?
Well, it's a turn-based game. It allows you to play like 10 turns an hour and refreshes 8 times a day. When I was first starting out, I was typically using my 80 turns a day. I've settled into about a little less than half that, but I go back 3 or 4 times a day to use my turns.
Mark, thank you. Mia?
I think, you know, what he's mentioning is, you know, and Frank was saying, we're seeing more diversity emerging. You know, some games are really trying to do more with things like their writing. You know, Big City Life has a little bit of the time management. You don't have to go back. You know, things don't expire if you don't. But it's also really tried to be very witty and funny and make you more interested in the things that you're doing rather than just, you know, planting a crop. You know, you're going on dates and doing different things. So I think that's definitely something that's emerging too.
Well, yeah, there is a theory that... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Frank.
Well, I was going to say that there is a theory that Facebook is kind of recapitulating the history of the development of video games in general, that they're starting with these very simple systems and over time getting more complex and developing and starting to bring in narrative and things like that. So we may see more things like Echo Bazaar on Facebook.
We have lots of comments at our website, onpointradio.org. Here's one from Jem Lee, who says, when I played SimCity on my PC 20 years ago, it was really about the game. You bought it once, you played it, period. Now we have to wade into a social network which exists only to extract personal information and monitor buying behavior and shopping preferences, gouging our consumer weaknesses, all the better to target you for the ad machine. We're all targets now, he says. And here's from Steve. The tragic irony of Farmville is that it deals in agriculture, hard work, and a sort of virtual ecology, but requires that participants become sedentary in order to be successful. And finally from Catherine, who says, I used to play Farmville until I realized it was taking too much time away from my little boy. I quit cold turkey, and now the only game I play online is Scrabble. I think I was drawn in by less the social aspect, more by the appeal of a little world over which I had complete control, unlike the real world. Does that sound right, Mia?
Exactly. When I've been talking with women who play games over the past 10 years, you know, one of the real interests, and I would say this is probably true of men as well, is that issue of control. And it's on many levels. You know, you decide when you play, you decide how much you play, you decide what game you're going to play, and then within it, you know, the choices that you're going to make. And something like SimCity there is also perfect. You know, you're controlling a world. You are the ultimate dictator of it, and you can kind of see what happens. And, you know, these games also offer you that kind of sense of control as well, which we usually don't have on a day-to-day basis.
So can you play these games alone? Talk about the social networking
here. Well, you can definitely play them alone, but you won't get very far. Some of the games are designed, you can do it by yourself, and they'll give you a fake friend to start out with, but they really encourage you to invite, you know, your friends who are also on the social network to play. And with your friends, you can give each other gifts, and these are things that you may need to advance in the game. You can visit each other, you know, either your farm or your city or your world or, you know, your apartment, whatever space it is that you've designed. And you can leave each other messages. But one of the interesting things and one of the drawbacks or I guess shortcomings of a lot of these games is that I don't think that they're really very social. You know, there are, when I play with my friends, I say with my friends, but I can visit their farm or their apartment. I can leave them a note, but it's really not the same thing as maybe playing an online game with them in real time or sitting down and playing a board game or a card game together.
You know, I hear this and I don't play these games, so I haven't done it. But is this all taking the place of authentic, real human interaction?
Well, I think it's all authentic and real.
On a computer?
Sure. There are people who are part of online communities that have changed their lives. And this is not just with games, but with other parts of their life. And there are other games and online communities that are ephemeral, that can feel very superficial and you know, may feel deep at first, but have no lasting effects.
Frank, do you worry about the face-to-face human interaction that somehow we're losing with these games?
No, not really. I mean, I think that it is true that most of these, while they're called social games, are pretty much single-player experiences with a little bit of social interaction around the edges. And I think that there's a world of possibilities for games that are more deeply social. But I think the concern about whether it's on a computer or not is kind of a red herring. I think it's still it's as legitimate as listening to music or watching a movie. I mean, these things are all kind of artificial and stylized. Their constructed experiences, whether or not they take place on a computer is kind of immaterial.
Here's Philip in Boston. Hi, Philip. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
The point I just want to make is sort of already talked about it a little bit, but in comparison to like how traditional gaming is done, I've been a big gamer for a long time, and sometimes I dabble with some of these social games, and it seems to me that a lot of their focus and their lack of evolution so far is just based on single-player style games, but with some Web 2.0 features, mm-hmm. and that's kind of made them pervasive in some platforms and some websites. However, the problem with that is that not everybody's into these sort of experiences, and I would like to see some of these platforms and some of these games become a little slightly more focused on catering to the people that actually want to see them and be able to filter those things out so that if you're interested in those things, you can see them. There are other social websites like Playfire and Raptor that have created like gamer-focused social media that people can check out if they're interested in those things. So. Mm-hmm.
Philip, thank you. I appreciate the call. Here's Raul in Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, welcome.
Hey, Jane.
Hi.
I wanted to make a comment that game designers typically cater to the biology of humans. So, like, every little game accomplishment and reward that one gets creates a small rush of dopamine. The same exact neurotransmitter used with illegal narcotics, whenever one's not playing a game, for instance, it's actually the absence of dopamine, and that's why you feel bored, your impulse to play the game. I wanted your thoughts on that.
Well, thank you. This goes back to the criticism of the addiction and the compulsion to play these games. It's
sure.
back to the element of, you know, pulling that slot machine, clicking and clicking, got to get that reward.
Yeah, I think that there's also a tension, you know, with some of these companies that are, you know, will admit that they did everything they could to make money. But also I've talked with a lot of game developers, and Frank can speak to this too, who are really conscious of, you know, how people play their games and how much. It's interesting. I mean, a lot of people in the game development community want their games to be addicting. You know, they say that, you know, like, you can't put it down. But when they really start talking about it, you know, they do have a sense of, you know, ethics in terms of, we don't want something that's going to destroy people's lives. You know, we want something that's going to enhance their lives, not turn them into just a button-clicking drone.
How do you respond to the caller, Raul? Frank?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's an interesting point. But things that produce dopamine are not inherently bad. I mean, lots of things produce dopamine, and lots of them are really good. And I think the real question is, you know, games are a form of culture, and you have to consider when you're making a game, what kind of game do I want to make? Like, what type of experience do I want to give my players? And if you are designing something that is manipulative, like a device whose only purpose is to produce a certain type of behavior in order to hook a player, and you're not thinking about how that game fits into their life and how it provides a deeper satisfaction, if you're really making something that you yourself would not want to play, where you don't think it really brings something of value to the person's life, then you're making a bad game.
Well, I'm hearing a lot of these are quite manipulative, though. I mean, you have to come back every 10 minutes and check your crops.
Well, you know, you have to come back or they'll die. And, you know, really, in the game sense, it's really not that terrible. And even within those games, there are choices that you can make where you're going away for the weekend. You know, you don't have to plant crops that come due every 10 minutes. You can plant crops that, you know, come due every 2 days. You can let your field lie fallow if you want to.
Here's Jonathan from Sanderville, Virginia. Actually, Sanderville, Georgia. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome to the program.
Hey.
Hi. Go ahead.
I just kind of had a comment. I live on an actual farm, an actual mm-hmm. working farm in Sandersville, and I run my own business. And I'm 32 years old, and I know a lot of people that are into games on Facebook. And I just kind of find it all a little absurd, and it just kind of strikes me as this detachment from reality that there are people who have virtual farms playing these games when there's so many real problems and real issues, and I listen to your show every morning. And we hear about these things that are going on, and I feel like my generation especially has fallen into this virtual world because they have so much control over it, and they feel helpless in the real world, but they're kind of gone into this other world where they don't have to do anything to affect the real world. And I feel like this is just kind of it's really kind of a negative, and I think I see it a lot in people my generation and younger.
Jonathan, thank you. I'm glad you called.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one question that, you know, game researchers are starting to ask players like that is, you know, are you using this? I mean, it can be a diversion in your life for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, even an hour a day. And, you know, we all need those kinds of diversions and that kind of fun. But, you know, does it become a substitute, like what you're saying, for, you know, taking action or doing anything? And we've seen this with, you know, the internet, just internet use in general. Are people using it as a substitute for getting outside of the house? People using television as a substitute? And I think that there will always be, you know, some people who, you know, take that easy way out. But we're still trying to see, you know, kind of to what extent people are using these games.
Let's go to another call in Camden, South Carolina. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet. Go ahead.
My comment is that, you know, what I don't like about the games that are on Facebook and some of the other sites, and Frank is, I've noticed that his opinion is everything is okay with him as far as the way things are going because he's designing these games. He's the one making money off of them. But the problem I have is that they are grooming, just as a predator grooms a child for what comes later on, they are grooming people by starting out not asking for money and credit card information or personal information to begin with. That comes later once they gain your trust, get you into the game. Then they want the money. Then they want the personal information. It's really not a good way to do business.
Mark, thank you. Frank Lentz.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say that my attitude is everything's okay. I mean, I am I'm a game designer and I'm a game player and I'm a snob. I love games and I am very critical of games and but to me these are not really, you can't distinguish the sort of ethical questions that you're bringing up from the questions of just that are more like aesthetic questions of like what makes a good game, because I think that the criticism that these things cost money or they're designed to, you know, because they fit into a business context, you know, they're designed to extract money from the customer. I mean, that's a criticism you can make about all forms of pop culture, all forms of commercial culture. You can make that about pop music and you know, even books and certainly movies and things like that. So these questions are complicated. I mean, I think it's the important thing is to say what kind of games, you know, what makes a good game? What kind of games do I want to play? What kind of games do I want my kids to play? And how do they fit into my life and how do they contribute something of value to my life?
Mia Consalvo, you're currently writing a book about Japan's role in gaming industry and social gaming. I know it's hugely popular around the world.
Right.
How would you describe it?
Well, I think that the game industry is really unique in that in terms of other media industries, it's not totally Western-dominated, or it wasn't at the start. You know, Japan played this huge role as games were getting going in the late 80s and early 90s. And in Japan, you know, there are all kinds of types, all different types of games as well. You know, you've got your console games. Arcades are still very big in Japan, and they have a lot more mobile games, you know, and they have social games that they play on those mobiles, but also on PCs as well. And it's really interesting to see kind of, you know, how players from different parts of the world play and, you know, like what are the different types of games that we're getting from these different countries and cultures.
In places like China where they're much more competitive in their social gaming.
Right. I went to a talk at the Game Developers Conference where they were talking about social games in China and mentioning that in one of the Chinese versions of a Farmville type game, you could go to your friend's farm at night and not fertilize their crops but destroy their crops. And in a hospital game, you could go to your friend's hospital and bomb it. So it's a type of interaction. It's just a different interaction than a lot of the social games we see here offer players.
Here's another call from Chris in Franklin, Tennessee. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I've been a gamer for quite a while, and I don't game too often a week, maybe 2 hours. But I've found that social networking game doesn't offer me the substance that I look for in a game when it comes to storyline and involvement in the game. I prefer to be immersed more in a world that's less domestic, such as Farmville. I want to be doing more, and I want there to be a serious story or consequences to the gamer's action.
Chris, thank you. Frank Lentz, how do you respond to that? Chris thinks this is not substantial enough for him.
Yeah, well, that's a criticism that mainstream gamers often have about this kind of game. And in fact, a colleague of mine, Jesper Juul, makes kind of the great point that a lot of the criticisms about social games that you hear from gamers are the same criticisms about video games in general that you hear from the rest of the world, that they're shallow, that they're just that they're addictive, that they're escapist, and in some ways, social games are the video games of video games. This is the way Jesper puts it. I think that you as a gamer yourself, sir, I think you've developed kind of a literacy that allows you to engage with deeper, more complex game systems, and I think you're getting a richer experience out of it. For many people on Facebook, this is kind of their first foray into playing video games, and they are just developing that literacy. They're developing those skills, and I think that they will end up gravitating towards richer, more complex games that are the same or similar to the kind that you play.
Mia Consalvo, wrap us up here. And for good or for bad, how will gaming fundamentally change social media?
Wow, gosh, if I knew the answer to that question, I could be writing a bigger book. I'm not sure. I think that they're drawing more people into social media. You know, I think that they have a more to do in terms of developing actual social interactions among people, but it does enhance people's day and their relationships with some of their friends and family.
Well, Mia Consalvo, visiting associate professor in comparative media studies at MIT's Gambit Game Lab. Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And Frank Lance from New York, creative director and co-founder of the game design company Area Code. Frank, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation on our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.